This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, September 11th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the results of an external audit on the University of Arkansas's Division of University Advancement. Plus, we get a tour of the newly renovated Vol Walker Hall on the U of A campus. The renovated space, as well as a new addition, will be dedicated tomorrow afternoon.
And we continue a new monthly series where we focus on three things you need to know about a specific subject. This month's topic, saving for retirement.
Those stories and more, but first, Arkansas housing data spanning the first 7 months of this year show home sales were up nearly 11% in the state compared to the same period last year. According to the Arkansas Realtors Association, sales numbers in the state also show a 13% increase in home values. Karen Croson with the Realtors Association says many anticipated evidence of a growing housing market. She attributes the recent growth in sales partly to interest rates that have started to climb.
And I think that has driven a lot of buyers who were sitting on the fence to go ahead and make a move. I've been doing this 25 years, and that traditionally happens when we see interest rates staying still for a while and you start to see a bump up in the interest rates that the increase in traffic occurs.
In the month of July, Arkansas saw a 19% increase in the number of residential units sold, with Benton and Pulaski counties ranking at the top in the number of sales.
The future site of the U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith has moved slightly. Last night, the museum board approved a plan to move the museum about 2,000 feet north from the original site location. Pat Mickle of the Fort Smith-based engineering firm of Mickle Wagner Coleman says the plan to move the site came after a land use assessment of the Westfall property along the Fort Smith riverfront, which included the original museum site.
In combination with things we were hearing about the kinds of volumes, like, for example, the Crystal Bridges, that their attendance level was much, much higher than they originally anticipated is. To some degree, the same thing was happening with the Clinton Library. We looked at the Marshalls Museum site and saw a site that was a great location in a lot of respects, but was hemmed in because of river on one side, city park on one side, highway on one side, gas well on a fourth side. They were kind of hemmed in for spaces. And if there was an opportunity or a need for growth in the future, they were pretty well in a difficult spot.
Mickle says the new site, which is farther downriver on the Westfall property, where there hasn't been as much development to date, is twice as large with 16 acres total, and it's also twice as deep and at least 15% wider. He says the larger lot gives the site planners different opportunities for development.
They didn't want a parking lot out in front of the museum. They were trying to put it off to either side. It gives them more depth to be able to develop up the sides of the property for trying to develop parking. The museum building itself, it's kind of hard to get a grasp on how big it is. The building's almost 450 feet long from tip to tip. It has some cantilevered roof structure sticking out from it, but I mean, it's a pretty long structure. This site also allows us, with this deeper front yard, to do some more things. The architects were talking about the ability through landscaping and stuff, give them some opportunities to dress the site up better and make it more attractive.
Additionally, with the original site, Mickle says the museum building would have been right against easement lines and required a setback from Riverfront Drive.
Benton County residents who were affected by flooding last month will not be eligible for federal assistance issued through the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management. Mike Dixon is the Assistant Director of Emergency Management for Benton County.
We received a letter from the state notifying us that the number of significant and damaged homes did not meet their thresholds.
Dixon says the individual assistance program managed by the State Emergency Management Department works on a point-based system. Though Benton County emergency management officials have requested from the state a breakdown of how points are awarded and what the thresholds for assistance are, the state has yet to respond to that query. Dixon says about 200 individuals contacted the county with damage reports following the early August storms.
Results are in for two special elections held yesterday, one in Benton County, the other in Madison County. The proposed 1 cent sales tax increase for public safety and building upkeep in Madison County failed with a vote of 785 residents opposed to the measure, 721 votes cast in favor of the tax increase. In the Siloam Springs special election, which was for a reallocation of an already existing sales tax rather than an increase, the measure passed with 554 votes in favor of the measure, 210 city residents voted against it.
The University of Arkansas has again moved up on the U.S. News and World Report's annual Best Colleges list. The U of A was ranked 63rd on the 2014 list of Best Public Universities, an improvement of 4 places since last year. In the overall ranking of 201 top-tier universities, the U of A is ranked at 128th place this year, an improvement over last year's overall ranking of 134. The U of A is the only public university in Arkansas to be ranked among the top-tier schools. Helping the university's ranking this year is an improved 60% graduation rate, a higher freshman retention rate of 83%, and improved ACT scores and grade point averages of incoming freshmen.
65 new jobs are expected in Fort Smith after another firearms-related manufacturer yesterday announced plans to move to the city. According to the City Wire, Thermal Magazines manufactures firearm magazines using plastic injection molding. The company is relocating its operation and headquarters from North Carolina to within the former Riverbend Industries plastics and molding plant. As part of the agreement, Riverbend will produce components for Thermold, and Thermold employees will handle assembly and distribution of the products. Riverbend was once a supplier to Whirlpool, but since the refrigerator manufacturing plant closed, its Fort Smith workforce has been reduced from about 120 to 85.
With warmer temperatures and drier weather across the state comes the increased chance of wildfires. According to the Arkansas Forestry Commission, the Southern Delta region of the state is at high risk for wildfires, and moderate wildfire risk exists for the rest of the state. As such, burn bans have been issued for 25 counties across the state, though none are in the Northwest Arkansas region. However, Washington County Fire Marshal Dennis Ledbetter yesterday issued a red flag fire warning for the county. Though not an outright prohibition on burning, the fire marshal's office discourages any outside burning until conditions improve, as every fire has the potential to become large, spread rapidly, and become difficult to control.
Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the mid-60s in northwest Arkansas, lower 70s for the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow, slight chance of showers. Highs will be in the upper 80s in northwest Arkansas, mid-90s for the River Valley. And for tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain. Lows from 62 in northwest Arkansas to the lower 70s in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. University of Arkansas officials say a 48-page audit indicates financial problems with the university's Division of Advancement was the result of mismanagement that led to overspending. The audit, conducted by the Division of Legislative Audit, was released yesterday, and university officials met with reporters a few hours later. University of Arkansas Chancellor Dave Gerhart says the audit, like internal investigations conducted earlier, found no fraud, theft, or misappropriation of funds.
There is some disagreement on technical accounting principles, as you will find in the audit, which we recognized and then subsequently made adjustments. The audit clearly shows this was a case of overspending by employees of the university who failed to maintain proper budgetary oversight. Briefly stated, they were borrowing on anticipated revenues to pay current bills. All expenditures, however, were for legitimate university needs in preparation for a major capital campaign.
Chancellor Gerhart says the money that was overspent, more than $3 million, has been accounted for to the penny. Much of the overspending stemmed from additional hirings to gear up for a multi-year capital campaign that university officials say could raise up to $1 billion. The university says the Division of Advancement's budget has since been balanced with a combination of cost-cutting and revenue-sharing between academic units. Chris Weirich, the new vice chancellor for advancement, hired in the wake of the overspending discovery, says much of the cost containment came from the elimination of certain marketing procedures.
We had a hefty number in the marketing to advance the campaign, and we cut that out. Other things were just day-to-day expenditures. We had something as simplistic as a courier service that we were paying $15,000 a year for. We found by using FedEx we could cut that to $2,000. We've looked at every single expenditure, even the coffee that we drink, and broken it down to what was necessary and what was not necessary. But a majority of it was marketing money for the campaign.
I think that amounted to about $700,000.
That is correct.
Like that. So it was a big chunk.
A great example I can give you is the piece that runs during the football games at halftime. If you're watching ESPN, last couple of years we've had external bodies, a group in Dallas, a marketing firm, produce that piece for us. We were able to do it in-house this year for about $32,000. It's just a matter of what we can be proactive in the department and turn out ourselves, as opposed to looking externally.
Chancellor Gearhart and other university officials answered questions from reporters for more than 45 minutes yesterday afternoon inside the University of Arkansas's administration building. They were asked how a situation that led to a more than $3 million deficit could occur.
Well, that's a good question. I think part of it has to do with the complication of how they're funded. They get funding from multiple sources. Part of it comes from university revenue. Part of it comes from private gift support. Part of it comes from the float on dollars that come into the foundation before they're expended, and they get that revenue. And part of it comes from basis points off of the endowment. So all of that together makes a complicating picture of trying to develop a budget. I can't really tell you why they didn't know. They should have known.
Don Peterson, the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration, says that unique funding system for the Division of Advancement made that department unusually susceptible to high-cost overruns. He says similar situations on campus should not be a concern.
Most of the campus does not have the unusual situation of the complexity of the resources that Advancement had. The closest other unit that to Advancement would be Walton College, and we have reviewed what they do, and they're doing a very good job in looking at all of their resources and managing them to a budget. So I think part of what we plan to put in place is a closer look at everybody, but the risk is not at the same level for other units as it was for Advancement.
Don Peterson, however, says steps are being taken on the university campus to make sure money management techniques are even more closely watched than before.
We're going to set up a system to monitor budgets much more closely, probably on a monthly basis. The provost has already introduced that to the academic areas, and they're reporting monthly. What we're trying to put together is a report with the right kind of information, so each unit's not having to generate that information themselves, and then let them have the information and use that as a tool to do a better job of managing. Not that they were doing anything wrong, but give them better tools to do an even better job in managing their budgets going forward. And I'm talking about people outside of Advancement everywhere on the campus.
Chancellor Gearhart was asked yesterday if he thought the deficit, the subsequent firing of two employees connected to the overspending, and the publicity surrounding the matter have given the University of Arkansas a black eye.
We have a solid fiscal position, the best position we've been in the history of the university. When I became chancellor a little over 5 years ago, we had somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million in reserves. We started this fiscal year with $50 million in reserves. We have increased our number of students here by over 6,000 students in that time. We've put into our physical plant something like $450 million. We've kept our tuition and fees low for our students compared to our counterparts. We've made great progress in the last 5 years. And on top of all that, our alumni have given us their confidence in supporting the university as generously as they ever have in the past, with $108 million this past year. So no, I don't think it is a black eye.
University of Arkansas Chancellor Dave Gearhart talking to reporters yesterday on the UA campus after an external audit was released in relation to overspending in the university's Division of Advancement.
An investor education series focusing on individuals thinking about retirement begins tomorrow at the Fayetteville Public Library. How Can I Afford Retirement is presented in part by the Garrison Financial Institute at the University of Arkansas's Sam M. Walton College of Business. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas recently spoke with the Institute's managing director, Dr. Craig Rainey, who says the program's target audience is Baby Boomers Plus. people 50 to 70 years old. During their conversation, Christina noted that the target audience is awfully close to retirement.
Some actually are, but that's true. Again, what we're really focused on is people that are thinking about retirement and, so say a 50-year-old. It could be of interest to somebody in their 20s or 30s that's at the early stages. And, of course, the sooner you begin planning for saving and investing for retirement, the more painless it's going to be and probably the better off you're going to be in retirement. And also for, say, people at 70, it's an issue of not outlasting your retirement assets.
I know that I don't necessarily fit into this age group, but, I mean, at 32, I mean, I have to start thinking about it now.
Now, I thought you were about 29, but in any case, actually, the sooner you start, as I say, the more painless it's going to be and probably the better off that you're going to be when you are in retirement. The ideal age, actually, I was talking to my students last night. I wish I had started when I was one or perhaps even before I was born. That would be the ideal time. And that's because of the power of compounding growth. It could be in dividends. It could be on price appreciation, that is, say, stock returns or returns on your bonds from capital appreciation. Bonds go up and down in price, too, just like stocks or other kinds of assets. And actually, Albert Einstein described the power of compounding growth as the single most powerful force in the universe. That applies in the case of investments as well.
What is the most important thing that somebody needs to know?
Well, I understand the series here is about the three things
right.
People need to know. So I was thinking carefully about that. And I think the three things people need to know, first of all, information, or think about this as education. They have to know about the issues surrounding retirement. Typically, people don't save and invest nearly enough in the investments they make. There's some issues with that. So people tend to overestimate their retirement income and underestimate their retirement expenses. So information is really the first of those three things that people need to pay attention to. The second issue is you have to develop a financial plan, a plan into retirement. And of course, we provide some resources, some ideas about how you can develop one of those. And then third is you have to have the self-discipline to stay the course and actually adhere to your plan. We're bombarded in society by messages from everywhere, commercials from our friends. You're not going to be happy unless you have the latest and greatest new product that's out, even though the one you may have works fine. And also to tend to buy things new as opposed to pick them up secondhand at a steep discount and save and invest the difference.
So going back to the first thing, information. And you mentioned, sort of a budget. I mean, is that just really just sitting down and looking at your budget?
Well, that's also a great question. I have often seen people recommend that people develop these complex, convoluted budgets. I actually have never met anybody that did that. The other approach is pay yourself first. So if you basically develop your spending habits such that you pay a substantial amount of your income to yourself first. And by that, I mean save it and invest it, say, in a diversified portfolio, work with a financial planner, or you can do it on your own, but make sure it's diversified and it's consistent with your goals, short-term, intermediate, and long-term. And everybody has goals or should have goals. Most Americans don't actually write them down, but you should. Yes, you could actually go through the exercise of budgeting every item. Very few people do that. The other way is pay yourself first and don't dig into those funds. You have to have the self-discipline to not do that.
So essentially, when I believe they're going to be announcing a new iPhone soon. So the new iPhone comes out. Don't dig into my retirement fund in order to purchase that new iPhone.
Exactly. Don't dig into your retirement fund for anything. And for somebody who's young, say 32, or I remember when I was 23, when I first graduated from university and went to work full time. One of the issues that I had at that age was the word retirement was so distant. I actually was in the Canadian Air Force years ago in the height of the Cold War, and we expected to actually go get killed in World War III. And retirement was a distant concept for somebody that's 23.
Oh, for sure.
If somebody had explained it to me, say, in these terms, instead of, say, a individual retirement account, think of it as an insanely rich account we're rich. It's for me, it's not about money as such. It's about freedom and independence. It's to be able to work because you want to, not because you have to. If you put it in those terms, even the power of the IRA, the individual retirement account, if you invest in a diversified portfolio over a very long period of time, using the correct knowledge and self-discipline, stick with it, that alone is enough to take care of your retirement. That's if you start at 23. Later on, there's even more powerful vehicles, of course, the 401k or for nonprofit employees such as the university, for example, or hospitals or in government, something called a 403b, which works the same. These things are incredibly powerful, and that's something that we cover in this series.
Well, so you mentioned working for a nonprofit or, you know, a state agency such as the university, which I am employed by the university. I really didn't start saving into retirement until I started working here. And so I was, you know, 29, 30. I mean, it's a really great program here. I mean, they match 10%. I put in the 10%. Am I on the right track?
Absolutely, but I would take it even a step further. The way the rules work, say, on a 403b plan, it's exactly the same as a 401k for a for-profit company. But with a 403b plan, say, I'm going to use round numbers. Say you made $100,000 a year. I'm not saying you do, but maybe
definitely
you do.
Definitely not. This is public radio.
Okay. But I'm just going to use it for round numbers. So say you made $100,000 a year and your employer had a 10% match. So if you put $10,000 in and your employer match is 10%, that means they're going to give you $10,000 into that account. So right off the bat, you've doubled your money. But it's better than that, because the $10,000 that you contributed to get the match is also tax deductible. So say you had a marginal, and it's the marginal tax rate that matters, the dollar you pay on each additional dollar of income that you make, because if you put that $1 into the 401k, then that's a dollar less that's taxed. So at the marginal rate, say if your tax rate federal was 28% and state is 7%, that's 35%. That's 35% you're going to save in taxes, get a refund back at tax return time. So really the $10,000 you put in only cost you $6,500. Now, is this exciting? Before we even start talking about taking risk in the markets, if you put in enough to get that employer match, do you realize you have tripled your money before you even take any risk? And then, of course, somebody like me, I'm going to be starting to take risk in the stock market, real estate investment trusts, master limited partnerships, all kinds of different things, sometimes bonds if bonds look attractive, and then take risks to grow that money that's in there. But think about that. We've tripled our money before we take any risk. Most Americans don't even put enough to get the match. And with a 401k, actually, for somebody like myself over 50, we're talking about the ceiling you can contribute is not just 10% of your income, depending on how much you might make, but it's actually $23,000 per year. So say you made the $100,000, you take the you put in your $10,000 to get that match, but you can still put another $13,000 in, and remember that $13,000, you still only pay 65% of it, so you're going to greatly reduce your taxes and increase your retirement savings that way. With the university, we even have something called a 457 salary deferral plan that allows you to put another $23,000 in that's tax deductible. And in these vehicles, 401k, 403b, 457 plan, not only are your contributions tax deductible, but you have tax deferred growth. That means you don't pay taxes on the growth that you make every year.
Sounds like a pretty good deal.
It's a great deal.
Yeah.
Some people call it loopholes. There's no such thing as a loophole. Congress passed these by design.
Right.
I believe it's every taxpayer's duty to pay the minimum amount of tax they can legally pay. And that way you can invest, look after your retirement, which is really something we're going to increasingly have to do ourselves.
All right. And so the three things, information, financial plan.
And self-discipline.
And self-discipline.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
Finance. It's where the money is.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Rainey.
Thank you.
Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas recently spoke with Dr. Craig Rainey of the Garrison Financial Institute. For more information on the retirement program series at the Fayetteville Public Library, visit gfi.uark.edu or call 575-4500.
It is Wednesday, September 11th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I didn't really realize that this was a week all about music. This is a week all about music.
I have no problem with this.
No.
This, for today, is a group called the Time Jumpers.
Okay.
They are kicking off the season at the Alma Performing Arts Center tomorrow night. 11 members who play Western swing. But one of the interesting things they do is take songs from other genres.
And turn them into Western swing?
And turn them into Western swing.
Do you know of an example?
I don't, but I know that they've had 2 Grammy nominations. And they have their first studio album coming out, or rather it came out last year.
Okay.
Should be fun. And that show happens at 7:30 Thursday at the Alma Performing Arts Center. If you've never been there, beautiful venue.
It really is.
And there's a Sonic on the way.
You know,
you
is
get
perfect.
Food. Tickets are $35 to $55 at 632-2129. Kyle didn't understand that, but you did.
Yeah, of course I did.
Well, that a girl.
Well,
I plan much of my day around Sonic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very it's a
good.
Thing.
No, that's fine. That's fine. All right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And that's when we realized we had overlooked one small but very important detail. We forgot to ask Sandra which bedroom window was hers.
I've been sheltered all my life by the humane practice of courtship and romantic etiquette. I was unprepared for how the rest of the animal world likes to go about love.
Flicks his wrist, sending the eggs up into the air into 2 perfectly laid out slow motion backflips. But something goes terribly wrong.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
If you've ever waited for a home or office renovation to be completed, you know this. Work always seems to continue until the very end. Last week, there was still some minor work to be completed and details to be tweaked at Vol Walker Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. The building has undergone a renovation and has had new space added, the Stephen L. Anderson Design Center, in the past few years. Though students, staff, and faculty moved in with the arrival of the fall semester, the formal introduction of the new space is tomorrow. Vol Walker Hall was first opened more than 70 years ago as the University of Arkansas Library. For the last 40 years, it's had its current role as the home of the Faye Jones School of Architecture at the U of A. Last week, just 7 days before the formal dedication, the lead architects for the project, Marlon Blackwell and Mark Herman, gave a preview tour of the older and newer parts of the space. I asked Marlon Blackwell, who was on the faculty at the school, if he had any qualms about being the architect for a project that was for architects.
Here we are designing a project for critics. So the first thing you do is you ignore all their criticism. We just put our heads down as a team and worked and did what we, I think, do best, which is not only the generation of an idea or ideas, but the execution of the ideas.
He says the project is an example of what it is to make commentary and what it is to demonstrate how that commentary can be useful. Blackwell says a significant part of the approach was to consider how the work would contribute to the University of Arkansas campus.
The campus has its own set of issues. We felt like we could help solve some of these. One of these was the main access that runs from Arkansas all the way to the football stadium that has never been fully utilized because of the book stacks that when this was a library kind of blocked you off, you had to go around it. So opening that up, which in effect allows the university to interface with us now. They can actually walk through it.
The architects say the building is, of course, for the students. Marlon Blackwell says there was a desire to make the space itself a teaching tool, to offer an example of how early 20th century building and design techniques compare and complement those of the early 21st century and vice versa. He says the architecture team wanted to show that the DNA of each era can be found in both. Mark Herman, an alumnus of the Faye Jones School and an architect with Polk Stanley Wilcox, says there was also an overwhelming need to increase the studio space available to students. He says the use of post-tension concrete in the new part allowed for fewer columns and much larger spans.
And as you see, as we go up into the second and third floors, you really get these wide open spaces to work with. That promotes the way that that the school wants to teach the studios. You'll see architecture, interior, and landscape all mixed in the same studio with no walls between.
One of the wide open spaces Mark and Marlon wanted to improve is one floor up from the main floor, a large gallery area that Marlon calls the central nerve center of Vol Walker. It's where, for decades, the major critiques of students in the college have happened. He says they wanted to keep the neoclassical atmosphere and details in this grand room, but give it an upgrade. He says the room long has suffered from poor lighting and poor acoustics.
So the way we resolved that was bringing in natural light from
north, south, and center.
North, south, and center, and developing a beautiful red oculus, what we look like I call a retoculus, that goes directly to the sky. So we take the sky, we bring it into the space, and of course with red, sometimes it's red, sometimes it's purple. So we talk about the ever-changing dynamism of light, another teaching opportunity, right? And this is one piece of glass, 8 feet wide by 20 feet long. So totally uninterrupted with your view to the clouds and the sky.
The natural light that enters from this skylight is complemented by even artificial lighting from above, a series of bulbs covered by an acoustic fabric. Again, Marlon Blackwell.
So it's like a 2,500 square foot lampshade, probably one of the biggest installations of this in the country.
Yeah.
And it has resolved all our lighting problems. It gives even lighting throughout the room.
The sound has improved as well. Acoustic paneling has helped deaden the room. Mark Herman says there's no better way to prove that than walking from the hallway outside the grand space and crossing the threshold.
Step into the room and notice how the acoustics change when we cross over into this. It's really dramatic the way the sound just changes.
And this is this was done by one of our own professors who's an acoustic expert, Dr. Tara Mersatti. Did all the acoustics for this and also did a lot of the daylighting for our Brissolet along the west elevation.
The new design center allowed the architects to create new opportunities for faculty and students. There are small rooms tucked away that can be used for eating or resting, a new theater that has room for more than 200 people, and two state-of-the-art projectors. The theater's seats and walls are bathed in red, not so much a nod to the ubiquitous Razorback accents all over campus, but a connection to the school's namesake.
Red is closely associated with Frank Lloyd Wright, who was the mentor and teacher of Faye Jones, and if you get Faye Jones, he was, always had the kind of red as part of his moniker, and so we just kind of pull that thread on through a little bit.
The older side of Vol Walker does maintain its neoclassical feel, even with the modern technological inserts that have been added. The walls and the columns have heft. The new Stephen L. Anderson Design Center, by contrast, feels lighter and more open. Glass hallways allow people to see across an entire section of the building. Windows practically place a viewer out of doors, seamless with the end of the wall. Marlon Blackwell says this is a zero-edge approach.
It's another way of detailing, right, where in the old way you added moldings and things to cover joints. Here we try to look at how we can transition from one material or one edge almost seamlessly, like it's like it's been shrunk wrapped.
The blending of inside and outside is subtle in most of the space. At the top, the mixture is an outright feature. The new side of the structure includes a green roof and has room for another should funding develop, and a combination classroom and patio called the Sky Terrace might just provide the best views of the Boston Mountains on campus. A large white wall can be used to project images for a lecture or presentation, and the open-air walls let a breeze blow through. Mark Herman says more hidden lighting provides appropriate illumination.
This is another space that changes dramatically when the sun sets. What you'll get is there's an artificial light in this large skylight here that basically pushes light onto this white wall here. It bounces off that wall and fills the space. There's also some small lights in these light slots, which look great from the outside. But when you're in here, there's no lights in the ceiling. So you just get this glow.
Primarily staff, students, and faculty will use most of the spaces in Vol Walker, but a new exhibit hall will be able to extend the connection of the people inside to the rest of the campus. Before expansion, there was very limited room to exhibit student work to the public or any room, really, to show a visiting exhibit to the public. Blackwell says most traveling exhibits require about 1,200 square feet. The new exhibit gallery has about 2,500 feet. And a glass wall on the west side will welcome outside attention to the art on the inside.
So we have
Exhibition Terrace.
And just how passersby consider the new Vol Walker Hall was taken into consideration as well.
One of the things we realized pretty early is that the east side, the very formal, symmetrical side, one approaches on axes, right? And you have space to do that. Here we're very compressed between Mullins and the new addition, so it's really about the oblique. So we really kind of set up ways to understand the building from an angle rather than from front head on.
A walking approach from the western side of the building reveals a large, continuous window covered with thin slices of angled glass. These fins keep the interior cool and provide a sleek wedge of art to the outside world. To achieve LEED status, the architecture team used locally made materials as they were able and would not venture too far away from the site when local materials couldn't be used. Mark Herman says they were pushed when they wanted to match new and old exteriors.
We wanted to use the exact same stone that they used 70 years ago on our building. We did the calculations. We found a quarry that was within 50 miles of the original quarry in Indiana, down in southwest Indiana, falls within our 500-mile radius for LEED criteria. And so we have actual stone that's quarried within 50 miles of the original stone, using it 70 years later.
The dedication for the reopening of Vol Walker Hall in the Stephen L. Anderson Design Center on the University of Arkansas campus is tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. The University of Arkansas Library Special Collection has put together both a digital and physical exhibit about Vol Walker Hall. The physical exhibit is inside Mullins Library and will remain up through January. You can find a link to the digital collection at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com, and also at our website a bit more from the architects about some of the amenities in the new and old parts of the Fay Jones School of Architecture.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Yesterday you had a story about the Bottle Rocket.
New gallery opening this month,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so had a couple other art things happening this week. Tomorrow, the Art Center of the Ozark is hosting a reception from 6 to 8 for its two current exhibits. The first is called Sensory Iconoclasts. Is this something that you've kind of talked about? I feel like I've heard you talking about this.
You've heard me talking about it, yes. It's bringing in a lot of local artists of different kinds working together.
Because it's kind of been over, this has been developing over some time.
Yes.
It was an idea by Case DeGuerro and Eve Smith. Case is a chef at
11 at Crystal Bridges.
Thank you. And Eve Smith helps with the art. It runs like the art program itself,
right,
at Art Center of the Ozarks. And so the idea is to pair an artist with a chef, and they create two pieces. You've got the culinary piece that the chef created, and it was on their restaurant's menu for like a month,
right,
or so. And then the artist created a physical art piece that was inspired by the chef. And so they're going to have that on display this month at the Art Center of the Ozarks.
I'm very excited to see.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Also very exciting, the second exhibit that they have going on, because they have those two gallery spaces, is called Coin by Dayton Castleman. He's the museum manager for 21C.
Correct.
And he talked to me about this a while back, and I was really surprised that he did art. I'm so used to managers just managing the store,
right,
as it were, and I didn't realize he created art too. But the exhibition is an immersive multimedia installation whose focal point is a translucent 20 by 12 by 8-foot reproduction of a section of the Montenay Amphitheater. So I'm very interested in that as well. The event is free and open to the public, and both of the exhibits will be on display through October 4th if you can't make it to the reception tomorrow.
And I believe Case, Eve, and Dayton will all be there.
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
At the ACO in Springdale.
Right.
Meanwhile, University Programs is hosting an exhibit by Craig Colarusso. It's called Cube Music. It will be in the Ann Kittrell Art Gallery, which was in the Student Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's up through September 26th. The reception is scheduled for 6 until 7:30 on the 18th inside the gallery. Cube Music is an installation incorporating sound, light, and sculpture. He, of course, had the sun boxes.
Right. We've talked to Craig before on the show. He had the sun boxes, these boxes that you put out, and they use solar energy to produce a note.
Right. And depending on how much sun, how many of them are getting sun,
how much of them are together, because
right,
he moves them around, so they're in different places, and where you're standing, it all sounds differently. And this is, I think this is kind of expanding upon that. From my understanding, it's like a large cube that you can go into.
Right, and there are different geometrical shapes that are cut into them, and it should be quite interesting.
It sounds really cool. So the reception, again, is from 6 to 7:30 September 18th at the gallery. The event is free to current U of A students, and they just show their ID and get in. It's free for the general public as well, but it's contingent upon seating availability. So students get first come, first serve.
And we both know from talking to Craig that he loves to talk about his work. And
he does.
If you stop and ask him questions, he will give you answers.
He will. And I'm sure he'll be there and happy to talk to anybody. And while we're talking about the university, I did want to offer some congratulations to the soccer team. Very excited.
This is historic for them.
I'm very excited. So they're off to a 6-0 start this season, and so they've moved up into the National Soccer Coaches Association of America rankings, as well as TopDrawerSoccer.com. They've earned the number 25 spot in both of those. But it's the first time in the program's 28-year history that it has garnered a national ranking. The Razorbacks are one of 15 teams who remain unscathed on the season with zero losses or ties. And that's among teams who have played more than three
right.
games. And Arkansas is just also one of nine teams left in the nation with a 6-0-0 record. And again, if you're not used to soccer, they do have ties. So one
right.
of those is ties, one of those is losses. But they don't
have
any.
Until you get to a postseason World Cup, and then you have
right.
to play.
And then
conclusion.
You have to play in a
right.
tournament. But during the season, ties are okay. So congratulations to them. They return to the pitch this weekend for their final non-conference matchups at Utah State and TCU. They will play Utah State at 5 o'clock Friday and TCU at 1 o'clock Sunday.
And this reminder, some of those matches you can hear on our university sister station KXUA. Not all of them, but some of them. So check their website, the athletic department website.
Perfect.
KUAF is supported by the Walmart Visitor Center Museum. This newly remodeled and expanded center is family-friendly and features two interactive galleries, plus the Walton's 5-and-dime 1950s-style soda fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m. 277-8493 or Facebook/Walmart Visitor Center Museum for more information. Live on stage in Northwest Arkansas presents classic rock musicians turned country recording artist Exile Sunday at 2 p.m. in the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Exile is remembered for hits like Kiss You All Over as well as Give Me One More Chance. Tickets and more information available at 855-9997 or on the web at liveonstagenwa.com.
The 2013 Jazz Eureka Festival is scheduled for this weekend and will feature Spyro Gyra as the headline act. The jazz fusion band formed in the mid-1970s and will perform Saturday night at the auditorium in Eureka Springs. Jay Bekenstein, one of the founders of the band, recently spoke to Robert Ginsberg, host of Shades of Jazz on KUAF. Through the years, the band has performed more than 5,000 shows and sold more than 10 million CDs and LPs. During their conversation, Robert discussed the band's personnel changes and asked Jay if the core philosophy of Spyro Gyra has remained the same.
In a broad sense, yes. I think that the band has always kind of stood for letting the people that are in it play the music they really want to play in the manner they really want to play it. In other words, being around for 35 years, we've gotten away with murder. Being ourselves. I mean, it's been an incredible blessing that we've gotten away with it. And so our MO was always to do what we wanted, and it's still there.
It strikes me that you and your group have helped create an entirely new genre of music in some ways. And, you know, the moniker of smooth jazz has a lot of different connotations to different people, but what strikes me is several things. One is that the creative drive that you brought to bear when you started making music wasn't about commercialism or genre creating. It was really about what you wanted to play.
It was also about a natural continuum. The time that I was a teenager kind of programming music into my head was a time when I got to listen to a lot of really great jazz musicians and also a lot of great R&B and Latin musicians as well. It was a very rich period. I was a teenager in the 60s. So the music I made was just a continuum of the music previous to me that I was hearing that inspired, and I was just hopping on the bandwagon. I love those musics. I combined them in a way that seemed very natural to us and was really fun to do. And that's all it was. I wasn't trying to create a genre. I was just trying to be on, you know, one of many on a long timeline of people influencing people.
I gather there was plenty of music in your house when you were growing up. I read that your mother was an opera singer. Is that right?
My mom was a very good classical singer, really wonderful singer with an enormous range.
And your dad was a jazz aficionado and a record collector.
My father played really good boogie-woogie piano, and he played clarinet. So it wasn't that he just didn't do it, you know, for his daily bread. He did it out of love. But bigger than any of that, you know, between my mother introducing me to things like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and Rhapsody in Blue and my father turning me on to Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, that was a pretty rich upbringing for a little kid.
There's an amusing story about how the band name came about. Would you share that with us?
Yeah, back to that club we were in on there was a sign out front that flashed jazz every Tuesday night, and the place was actually called Jack Daniels, which coincidentally was what we always would imbibe there. And we were pretty late in the night, and I was pretty deep into the Jack, and the club owner, business was kind of going okay, and the club owner said, you know, you guys really need a name. He was very adamant about it, and said, you know, if you don't come up with a name, I'll get somebody else, something like that. And I remember this algae I studied in high school came to my mind through my bleary mind, out came Spirogyra. And he misspelled it on the sign the next week, and that was it ever since.
So based on an algae that grows in the ocean, right?
I think it's actually kind of fresh water. It's basically, a long filamental algae that grows in ponds and streams.
Okay, I see. Well, the name...
Grow in your pool if you don't take care of it.
Okay. Well, the name is safe. It's served you well, I think, you know. At this point, it's iconic.
And something served us well. Certainly, as the days went on and we needed to copyright the name and stuff like that, but nobody had taken it. we were good. It was unique, but really, I remember being out when success first started hitting us with record sales. It was such a shocker. I mean, nobody had planned for it at all, and I do remember sitting there going, I cannot believe that for who knows how many years I'm going to be stuck with the name Spirogyra. and really kind of regretting that I had been, you know, whatever, I hadn't thought about it more. And in fact, that I hadn't come up with some kind of cool name like the San Francisco Jazz Collective that had some, you know, some kind of gravitas to it.
Oh, but that's so boring. There's so many collectors.
Well, I was very pretentious. So anyway, by the third year, I'm starting to go, you know, this name really represents what we do. It's really energetic, and the name sounds like motion, and the Iranian cab driver in New York remembered it. So, you know, I'm happy with it these days. It's a silly name, but it has indeed, as you said, served us well.
You're going to be performing, I believe this is probably your first time in Eureka Springs. You performed in Fayetteville. We were talking about this a little bit earlier at the University of Arkansas. I saw you there. It was probably the mid to late 80s because Dave Samuels was still in the band. And I want to put it in the late 80s. But I don't think you've ever performed in Eureka Springs, and you're going to be performing in this historic auditorium. It's called The Auditorium. So, and you guys are still touring quite a bit. On the average, how many dates are you doing a year now?
60, 70.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. We really are. You know, if the quality of people in my band is so high that if we weren't working enough, other people would they'd be playing with others. We have to keep working. It's one of the things that keeps the band together, that we're able to, you know, support ourselves with this band and don't have to be mercenaries
right.
all the time,
right?
Like many.
Are there new frontiers you're still trying to explore?
Yeah, but they mostly have to do with raising my kids.
You don't have to explore those. They're gonna jump down your throat, I think.
I think you're right about that. It's forced exploration. I'm locking the Arctic on my exploration. Uh-huh. Musically speaking, I hope so. I know that, you know, speaking for myself, and I don't even know if this is a new thing. I think one of the early parts of the Spyro thing that has maybe disappeared a little bit over the 30 years is a connection the band had to Brazil and Brazilian music. And I'm sort of thinking personally, maybe I might go down to Brazil and do a Brazilian record myself. As for the next Spyro record, we have one coming out in September. It's a really great record. So what Spyro's going to do next isn't the first thing on my mind right now. We're actually in rest mode.
I see.
Because we're just getting ready to put out a record.
Once again, thank you so much for taking the time.
Really my pleasure, and we so look forward to playing in Arkansas. It's been too long.
It has been. It's been way too long. Thank you, Jay.
That was Jay Beckenstein, a member of the jazz fusion band Spyro Gyra, speaking to Robert Ginsberg, who hosts Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night at 10 here on KUAF. Spyro Gyra will perform at 7:30 Saturday night at the Auditorium in Eureka Springs as part of the 2013 Jazz Eureka Festival. More information is available at jazzeureka.org.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. The 7th Annual Ozark Mountain Artist Tour will take place Friday, September 20th through Sunday, the 22nd. It's a self-guided scenic driving tour in Newton County with stops to meet various artists and view their work in a variety of media. Maps and more information at ozarkmountainartists.com.
The Yonder Mountains Harvest Music Festival is hosting its annual songwriting contest and fiddlin' and pickin' contest in October. Submissions are due by September 16th and spots are limited. More information is available online at yonderharvestfestival.com/activities.
I've got some movie passes to give away.
Okay.
We're going to give away two.
Okay.
Let's ask a question.
Okay. Well, on this date in 1850, the Swedish Nightingale, as she was known, gave her first concert in the U.S. at Castle Garden in New York. Our question is, who is the Swedish Nightingale?
Look at a Fort Smith city map for a clue.
Yes, there's a street named after her in Fort Smith. So there's your hints.
Yes. ozarksatlarge@gmail.com with your answer.
Yep. Give us, and you have till tomorrow to figure it out, and we'll announce the winner tomorrow on tomorrow's show.
Right. So two Malco movie passes, good for any Malco theater in our listening area.
Yep. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith.
Barling.
Perfect. Down in that Fort Smith area.
That's right. Was going to go with Boxley Valley, but decided not to. We'll do that tomorrow.
Okay. You can do that tomorrow.
Okay.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Graham.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Kyle will be back along with Christina Thomas. Thanks again for listening, and have a fantastic Wednesday.